Support for I Am the Law is brought to you by Rutgers Law School. Get connected to a massive network with opportunities in New Jersey, New York, and Philadelphia at an affordable price. Learn more about this close-knit community and the largest law school in the Northeast by visiting law.rutgers.edu. From Law Hub, this is I Am the Law, a podcast where we talk with lawyers about their jobs to shed light on how they fit into the larger legal ecosystem. I'm Kyle McEntee. In this episode, I interview a legal aid attorney who does child advocacy through education law and as a guardian ad litem. Support comes from Vermont Law and Graduate School. Vermont Law and Graduate School empowers students to dream big. It welcomes and shares passions for social justice, the environment, criminal justice reform, and so much more. At VLGS, realism and idealism collide. Together, students and faculty positively transform the world around them. From an accelerated two-year JD to an online hybrid JD, VLGS offers innovative programs where you can learn at your own pace. To learn more, please visit vermontlaw.edu. Support also comes from Baylor Law School, the smallest and oldest law school in Texas. Baylor Law has 3 entering classes, 15 tracks of study, strong bar passage and employment rates, robust scholarship offerings, numerous clinics and joint degree programs, and a focus on preparing excellent and ethical lawyers. Visit the Baylor Law website to learn more and to apply for free to the spring, summer, and or fall entering classes. We're joined today by Hannah Wagner, staff attorney for the Legal Aid of Southeast and Central Ohio, where she primarily focuses on education law and family law. Hannah is also a guardian ad litem. Hannah, before we get into your education practice, tell me about how your family law practice is different than a standard family law practice, given that many of your cases involve domestic violence. What sort of matters do you handle on behalf of these clients?
I do custody, divorces, civil protection orders, and then the guardian ad litem as well. And all of my cases regarding family law does have to include violence for it to get through our intake process because we are so short-staffed, we can't take every low-income divorce that comes in. So we have that qualifier that violence does need to be involved.
What is the definition of violence that you all use?
Basically, just any sort of self-description. So if someone calls in and says, my partner has been throwing things at the wall or has hit me or slapped me. Usually verbal and emotional violence is involved, but if it's not accompanied by anything that would be like threats of death or threats of suicide, then it might not be as considered as high level as other forms of abuse.
It's got to be difficult to say no in those cases.
It is incredibly difficult. I think that's probably the worst part of my job. I will go through an initial phone call with them and I explain, like, I may not be able to take your case because we can't take every case. But at the very least, we always try to provide at least some sort of advice or next steps or something like that to at least help them and send them on their way. But it is hard to give that phone call and say, hey, I'm sorry, I can't represent you. And it usually comes with a lot of tears and it is rough for someone who, when I see other people cry, I start to cry. And so it's a difficult time. I think that's the worst part of this job.
So when you're trying to provide them some sort of advice, I'm imagining you're connecting them to some other local services. Are there other lawyers you can connect them to, or is it mostly broader than that?
It's mostly broader than that. It's usually I'll try to kind of connect them to services that might be helpful, like send them to JFS, Job and Family Services. But a lot of it is just like, hey, you told me about this text message. Here is how you use it in court if you're going to represent yourself. The attorneys in my area, not a lot of them do pro bono cases just because I'm in rural Ohio. And so there's not as many attorneys available.
So you also do some education law. What are the kind of issues you're encountering there?
So I would say the majority of education law that I practice has to do with some sort of special education. So I help parents in IEP meetings, which are individualized education plans, or 504 meetings, which help students receive accommodations, even if they're not getting specialized education. But we also do a lot of discipline cases. So if someone is being suspended or expelled, something that's out of school discipline or a change in placement, we will usually go and represent a student either at their hearing or at their manifestation determination review to decide whether or not a disability was the cause of this behavior that they're being punished for. And if that's the case, then they cannot be expelled from school. We also do a little bit of bullying advocacy where we'll help a parent and the student come up with a safety plan with the school that hopefully can deter any further bullying.
Who's the actual client here? Is it the parent? Is it the child? Is it both?
It's the child, but a lot of what I do is both. So the child is ultimately the client. I always have to talk to them and ask them what they're wanting, what they're thinking, with the understanding that I'm also talking to their parents. And so if they want to tell me something that they don't want their parents to know, I just let them know that that's fine. So that's really ultimately up to them whether they decide to share the information with me. Especially with IEP meetings and 504 meetings, a lot of times the students don't get involved because it can make them feel really horrible. Like they're hearing about all of these things that they're doing wrong, quote unquote, and all of these things that make life so difficult for the teachers that it's traumatizing. So we try our best to prepare with the student, recognizing that they might not be in the room to speak for themselves.
So when you are having those conversations where you're telling the child, we have attorney-client privilege, they're probably not used to someone being willing to talk to them who won't then turn around and talk to their parents. How do you assure them that, no, like, I'm not going to share your secrets?
So a lot of it is just talking with them, saying, hey, I know that like your parent makes a lot of decisions in your lives, but here you are my client. What you say goes. I cannot go over that. Otherwise, I am in violation of my own job. So trying to reassure them that like, if I don't follow through with this, I'm going to get in trouble sort of thing.
That's smart. We talked about the limited resources of your legal aid and just legal aid in general.
Sure, yeah.
What are the factors that allow you to take a case in the education space?
So at least for my office, we have a specific grant in Licken County through the Licken County Foundation that allows us to focus a lot more on education cases. So because education cases come in so rarely, I am able to take pretty much every education case. And I find that even if it's something that can be resolved with a phone call to the school, a lot of times the school will actually resolve the problem if the attorney is the one calling. So honestly, a lot of my education cases do not take me that long. It's like, hey, someone reached out, this is an issue. And they're like, oh, we didn't realize. And then they fix it, even though technically the parent has been calling them every month or something.
So they did realize that they're just afraid of you.
Yes, exactly.
All right, so going back to the domestic violence cases. So you mentioned that you're often in court for civil protection orders, custody disputes, and divorce. Do you also go to court for those education issues ever?
I have not done that yet. It's a possibility, but usually education cases are through administrative hearings. So if there's an expulsion, that's an administrative hearing with the school board. If the school board, if I want to appeal their decision, I go up to the state board. And then if I want to appeal that decision, then it will go into state or federal court, depending on what the issue is.
So I think people have a general understanding of what it looks like to be in court. What does it look like to be an administrative hearing?
Each school district is different and they can have their own policies. A lot of it is actually very informal, where we're just discussing, here are the issues, here's his past or her past, here's why this diagnosis may relate to this issue. We can also kind of call in experts like the child's therapist that's not through school, stuff like that. So it's more of a conversation, although once you get higher up in the process after you appeal, it gets more and more like a court hearing. So you're sitting around a table, but you're still having to wait your turn. You're still having to say objections, stuff like that. But usually the first prong of an education case is a very informal hearing.
Is there an attorney on the other side in those cases in that early stage?
Yes. Usually it's, again, up to the district. For any IEP meeting or 504 meeting, the district's policy for all of the districts that I work with are to have their attorney present if the parent has an attorney present. So I always warn the parents that that's the case. Like, you're going to bring me in and this might be more adversarial than cooperative. If that's the way you want to go, that's perfectly fine. But just to give them a heads up, because usually with IEP meetings, you want to cooperate. You want to find what is the best education for this child. Best is not the legal standard, unfortunately, but that's the goal.
So what is the legal standard?
Under the IDEA, Individuals with Disability Education Act, the standard is free and appropriate public education, or FAPE is what the generalized term is, which basically means education specialized to the student to allow them to progress. And that is the standard. It's not what is best, what is more beneficial to them. It is just what is the bare minimum to get them to progress from where they're at now.
And so what does that mean?
Great question. That, again, is just very jurisdictional. There's several circuit cases that will describe different things. There's not a whole lot of Supreme Court cases. There's a couple. But basically, if your student is receiving an IEP, they're setting goals. And so the goals have to be met by the end of like a quarter. And so the school is supposed to provide progress reports throughout that. And if the student is not progressing, then the IEP meeting gets reconvened and they set different goals to ensure that the student is progressing in some way, shape, or form.
I guess I want to believe that every educator wants to see their students progress. And so if that's the minimum standard, and yet you're still having to argue about it, that means that maybe they're not looking at it in the way I'm hoping.
Yes, I have a lot of bias against school districts. I would say teachers have it rough. Regardless if a teacher is super helpful to a parent, when they're in that scenario in the meeting or in court or in a hearing, they're going to be protecting their job, because then otherwise they can't help other students. So even if a parent is like, oh, this teacher is going to be a great witness for us, I always have to say, like, yeah, maybe, but usually that's not my experience. They usually will be tampered down by the district.
And really, it probably just comes down to resources, right? The reason there's lack of progress is there's not enough resources being provided to the teacher.
Exactly. Yep. And even when you're discussing with the school, like, say this student needs a one-on-one aid, the school has the responsibility to provide it, but there are so few aids out there that it's hard. And so I get that aspect. But yeah, it's a weird balance of this is what the student needs and you have the obligation to provide it. I'm sorry that you don't have the resources to do so, but I'm here to make sure that this happens.
I Am the Law is supported by Rutgers Law School, who knows that no matter your background, there is a place for you at their school and in the field of law. Rutgers Law has a long-standing commitment to diversity, equity, inclusion, and belonging. The MSP program is one example, helping students from underrepresented communities thrive in the legal profession. The program's impact has been felt widely in social justice, corporate legal practice, politics, and the judiciary. Participants have built these accomplished legal careers with the support of the Rutgers Law community. When you apply, just indicate your interest in MSP on the application. Support for I Am the Law also comes from William & Mary Law School in historic Williamsburg, Virginia. William & Mary's mission is to educate highly skilled, passionate citizen lawyers who will use their legal skills to change the world. The William & Mary experience includes small class sizes, dedicated faculty and staff who are deeply invested in each student's success, and a supportive community. Your journey to becoming an extraordinary advocate can begin at William & Mary Law School. You mentioned that you also do some bullying cases. Can you talk to me a little bit about what that entails? Because it seems like in some sense, that's just something a teacher should resolve.
Yeah, I agree. That's not always the case. Actually, a lot of the cases that come in regarding bullying are the teachers bullying the students, calling them specific names.
So
that is very problematic. But usually the way that I'm involved, I would say, is there's not a whole lot I can do with a bullying case other than have a meeting with the school and implement what's called a safety plan. So that safety plan can look like changing the student out of that classroom. It can look like having their friends walk them down the hall when they're usually yelled at by some other student, change seating arrangements, things like that to ensure that whoever that bully is, they are staying away from that student. A lot of parents will try to have meetings with the bullying student's parents. That's generally not when I'm involved. And a lot of times I find that those parents don't want to go to those meetings and they're not required to do so. So really the only thing we can do is put on a piece of paper, hey school, this is what you should be doing to address this.
That's got to be very fact intensive as opposed to some legal standard you're applying.
Oh, yeah. I think the way I would best describe it is creative advocacy. So you get a lot of opportunity to create your own solution, try and find the most creative way to handle this problem, because a lot of it is not going to be relying on the law. It's going to be relying on the school policies and how best to assist the student in a way that the school is able to do so.
How did you learn to advocate so creatively?
When I was in law school, I had this professor, Shelley Cavalieri in Toledo. She taught property, and I always thought property was going to be so boring, but she always taught it in a way that brought it back to social justice, which is something I'm very interested in and how I started at this job in the first place. And so when she was teaching these, what would be normally considered dull topics, she would bring in social justice and how to creatively come around statutes that may not be very easy to get around. I would also say that my managing attorney, Bill Canterbury, he has been an enormous amount of help. I never considered myself a creative person. So when I got this job and I started doing advocacy, I was like, I just don't have any creative ideas for this solution. And he was always great at kind of like bouncing ideas off me and encouraging me to look at different areas and see what other people are doing nationally. He's actually the reason I went to a conference in Atlanta recently. It was put on by the Council of Parent Advocates and Attorneys for special education cases. And I learned so much from them, which was really cool as well.
What are you seeing on the bullying front?
I would say that bullying, for one, is hard to tell just from my practice because a lot of students don't end up going to an attorney because they're getting bullied. But from what I've seen, the increases in bullying usually is tied around a hot topic. So right now, there's a lot of anti-LGBTQ plus bills being introduced in Ohio and all over the US. So I have seen an increase in bullying against LGBTQ plus students.
That makes sense. Even though you're relatively early in your career, you've already had the opportunity to start the guardian ad litem practice in your office. So what kind of work do you do in that role?
A guardian ad litem, or a GAL, is someone appointed by the court, a third party, to come into a custody case, whether it's divorce or just custody in itself, to kind of investigate what's in the best interest of the child. That's the legal standard, the best interest of the child factors. And so I go in once the court thinks it's necessary. So again, if there's violence, if there's drug use in the home, that sort of scenario. And I will interview the child, I'll interview the parents, everybody who is in the household, I'll do home visits. I get an enormous amount of records, medical records, mental health records of the child, of the parents, any other party that might be in the home, criminal records, and I accumulate that investigation into a report for the court. And I lay out what my investigation was, what happened, and then I provide recommendations to the court based on that. And that's another kind of avenue that I can use that creative advocacy part, because not only can I say, hey, I think it's in the best interest for mom to be the residential parent and dad to get supervised visitations, but I can also say like, hey, I think dad needs this co-parenting class, or I think it would be helpful if dad enrolled in drug therapy scenario, or just come up with different ways to assist the parents to get as much time with their child as they possibly can. Because I think that is helpful to the child.
This might be the wrong word to use, but I'm going to use it anyway.
Okay.
What is the discovery process like for uncovering that information that's relevant to your determinations as to what your recommendations are?
So for me, it's pretty easy. The court just orders the parties to sign releases for themselves and for their children. And then I go and I interview them and say, hey, what doctor do you see? What mental health counselor do you see? It's very invasive to parents, but I think it is also very helpful because in the cases where I'm assigned, both parties are usually pro se, so they don't have an attorney. And so when they're presenting their cases, they don't know what the judge or the magistrate is looking for. I have to sit in for the final hearings, and the parties go first. I have seen them not even bring up the alleged sexual abuse that occurred to the child, which is like a big portion of my report. And so I'm able to give a better story to the judge or magistrate so that they can make a better determination for the child.
So you have to have a lot of really sensitive conversations. How did you learn to have those conversations successfully so that you can get the information you need without traumatizing the person you're talking to?
I've had a significant amount of training through the Ohio Supreme Court puts on specific GAL trainings, and we are required to go through, I think it's 12 hours before you even start doing GAL work, and then you have a continued 6 hour of continued education to stay a GAL. Those series have been very helpful, especially with interviewing a child and knowing where they're at in their state of development is incredibly helpful to how I will gear my interview tactics.
So you don't necessarily need to be an attorney to be a GAL, but are there benefits?
Yes, I would say there are. Non-attorney GALs can't write motions, so I do a lot of drug testing motions to continuously throughout the case so that we can see like, hey, at the beginning, mom tested positive for meth. Hopefully by the end, she's not doing that so that we can hopefully see a progression of the parent trying to work on seeing their child. I also can call my own witnesses at the final hearing. So if I think someone's very relevant to the case that neither parties have called, I can call that person as a witness. So basically, I can do pretty much anything a normal attorney would be able to do, but a non-GAL or a non-attorney GAL cannot do those things, and they'd have to hire their own attorney for the case to do that.
Are you paid by the court in Ohio?
No. So the reason this program at our organization is so new is because GALs get paid by the parties, at least in the domestic relations court. In the juvenile court, I think the court may provide funds. I only work in the domestic relations court, but usually the parties pay and the court orders like a down payment, even if neither party is the one who wanted the GAL in the first place and the court said, you're getting one regardless, the parties still have to pay. So for me, since I work at a nonprofit, I get paid for my time regardless. So as long as I'm doing my job through my organization, I'm going to get paid. So this is an opportunity for us to have a no-cost GAL for low-income folks because people who cannot afford a GAL are just out of luck. And there are some pretty severe penalties for not paying GAL fees, which include contempt of court, which can come with jail time. So we think it's really important that people have access to free GALs. And so that's why we started that program.
You have a lot on your plate right now. How quickly did you build this caseload when you started at Legal Aid?
It was a very slow progress when I started. So I would go around and watch the other attorneys in my office. I would be as co-counsel for them, sit second chair, and kind of see how every attorney in my office does a case because everybody practices differently. So it's cool that I was able to see a bunch of different styles before I was thrown into court. I would say my first case I got was probably 2 weeks after I started. And then it was slowly adding on to that until I was at a normal caseload. And I don't think I was at a normal caseload until maybe 2 or 3 months into practicing.
So when you were first starting to get cases doled out to you, were you able to choose your focus or was it just whatever comes in the door?
So my managing attorney wants us to practice a little bit of all the different cases before we start choosing what we like. The way we describe it is we're generalists, but we have like a college major. Starting out, I'd get consumer cases, public benefits, and then I found that I really enjoyed family law. We had just one education attorney in our office, and she was incredibly knowledgeable, but then she was leaving. She was moving away. So they were like, oh, who's going to do our education cases? And I was like, that sounds very interesting to me. My stepmom's a Montessori teacher for 3 to 6 year olds. Like, I've always been ingrained in the education world. And so she took me under her wing and taught me the ropes of the education realm. And then I've continued on going to conferences, going to different trainings to build on those skills.
So your organization covers a lot of different counties. Are there a lot of other attorneys like you around doing the same work within the organization?
We cover 36 counties. My office specifically just does 4 of them. But even though I'm the only education attorney in my office right now, we have what's considered substantive teams. So we have an education team where all the people from different offices and from our Columbus office will meet together and we'll discuss some issues that we're seeing. When I first started out, I was like, here are all of my cases. I have no idea what to do next. And they would just kind of help me along and show me where to look if I needed to figure out what kind of statute was implicated or things like that. And so it's been a really helpful dynamic. There's also the statewide task force. So it's all the legal aides in Ohio. We have specific task force. So we have a housing task force and we have an education task force. And so I'm part of that as well. And so if someone in my organization cannot help me out for next steps or where to look, someone in the state usually is able to help.
So imagining that there's a family law team, there's an education law team. Are there also GAL teams?
There's not. We have a little group of people where we want to do a study to show why no-cost GALs are important so that we can get more state funding for no-cost GALs, whether that's through our organization or to provide for private attorneys. Either way would be great, just so that we can have that as a point of access. So I am the first GAL in our organization, and we're trying to have someone from every office be a GAL. And so I think once that kind of starts, we probably will have our own sort of team of some sort.
And it sounds like it'll be your team, right? Since you're the first one.
Yeah, yep, I think so.
I mean, I think that's an exciting leadership opportunity, right? Tell me about why that excites you.
I really love helping people. So I enjoy being someone who takes the new attorney in the office to court or being co-counsel on a new attorney's case, because I just love inserting myself in that position. I enjoy seeing these other people learn and develop. And that's really cool. So I am very excited for once we get more GALs to be able to share, like, here is my first report I wrote versus here's my most recent. These are the things that I learned throughout that process. And so I'm excited to kind of impart my knowledge on them, even though I feel like I'm so new to the profession anyways, that it's an odd opportunity, I would say, but I'm very excited about it.
So you didn't realize you wanted to go to law school until late in your undergraduate career, but
yes.
You say that legal aid was your dream job. How did those pieces fall into place?
I have always been very social justice focused. And I originally went to undergrad thinking I was going to go into the FBI and catch bad guys and all of that fun stuff. But then as I progressed throughout college, I minored in women, gender, and sexuality studies. And I realized a lot of what I am passionate about, I might have a more impact if I was a lawyer rather than an FBI agent. And so when I took a sociology of law class my senior year of undergrad, I realized, like, this is it. This is the piece that I needed. I think I can have a lot more impact on the world if I am an attorney.
I'm the Law is a Law Hub production. Don't forget to subscribe and rate this show on your favorite podcast app.